3 or 4 hours. I received some feedback that both Dr. Parker and I are going too fast. Well, tough cookie. Actually, it is something of a dilemma on our part to try to cover some of the big pieces and not allow those of you who are really conscientious to take adequate notes from the slides. Those of you who want that material, we can probably direct you to a portion on the website where you can find it for free. Those of you who don't want to do the internet thingy can probably find most of the material in the books that we brought here. So I will warn you this morning as I get into this age dating stuff that we're going to be moving rather fast. And I would suggest that rather than trying to copy the information from the slides, you sort of pin me down and ask me where you can find that information if you want to use it in your own ministry. I've mentioned this several times in the talk last night. Dr. Parker referred to it as well, that sort of the big issue is this thing of age. Now, there's a lot to it, so it's not a simple issue, but it is important that you understand we're dealing with something here that is almost, it's almost like a sacred cow, I guess, in some ways. We've done a lot of questioning in Christian circles, and we'll find people say things like, oh, no, I don't believe in evolution. Well, then how old do you think the earth is? Oh, it's billions and billions and billions. The reason for that, of course, is that idea has been sold in almost everywhere that you can think of, in almost every venue, even from the commercials. It's just everywhere. Anytime you turn on a documentary on television, it starts off with millions of years ago. That's just the opening mantra. The main reason for this, of course, is in evolutionary thinking, you have to have an old Earth or an old universe or unthinkable amounts of times in order for evolution to even seem plausible. But the flip side to that is, if you can undermine the biblical presentation at Genesis level, I mean, there's just no hint of ages in the Bible anywhere. There just really isn't any hint. And when you read it just like an ordinary person would read it, you wouldn't read ages into Genesis 1 and 2. You wouldn't read ages into the other accounts in the Psalms and the prophets and so on. So if you can undermine the credibility of the Bible or make it look like it's an allegory or something like that, then you can begin to undermine some of the other teachings in Scripture, and that's exactly what's happening, of course. I love the way scientists do these things. Given so much time, he says, the impossible becomes probable, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. I mean, think of what he's saying here. Do you catch what he's saying? If I have enough time, anything seems ordinary. I can throw an impossible scenario into billions of years. Time performs miracles. Now, the only trouble was he wasn't teaching to people in a joke. He was writing this in an answer to the critics who say there's just not a lot of evidence for this time factor. What we would say from a scientific perspective is there's an awful lot of science now, empirical science. Maybe I should insert this thought to you. I haven't covered it yet. But true science is that which you can test, reproduce, and falsify. Those are the three criteria for a scientific method, okay? In fact, those terms are in a Supreme Court decision back in the 60s that did away with the majority view standard for science. And now, in order to present scientific evidence in a court of law, it must meet those three criteria. You have to be able to test something based on what you observe or predict. Then you have to be able to reproduce that test or at least document what you did so well that other people can reproduce the test. And that last factor, falsification, just means you have to understand what you did well enough to know that if something else happened that could prove you wrong would happen, you would know what that thing is. Are you with me on this? In other words, you got to know what would make your theory fall apart. That's falsification. So to be science, you've got to have testability, reproducibility, and falsifiability. But we would suggest that real science, empirical science, testable, reproducible, falsifiable science, would certainly present an Earth far too young for evolution to take place. We'll cover some of that this morning. Dr. Parker will be talking about the Grand Canyon later, right after lunch, and you'll want to talk to him more specifically about this. But essentially, anytime you see these layers in rock cuts, think pancakes, okay? That's essentially what they are. All of them are laid down by some catastrophic process. They are sedimentary rocks. Do you know what that word means? Sediment, mud flows, particles laid down by hydraulic factors, usually water. And every time you see those layers in the earth crust, they're usually sedimentary rocks, water-deposited rocks. Igneous rocks, heat-related rocks like granites and basalts, lavas, those are flowing liquid rocks. You don't find fossils in lavas or granites. You find fossils in mud flows, in limestones, and things of that nature, okay? The question is, whenever you see one of these lines, another pancake layer, what you're really looking at is a change in hydraulic factors. Either the speed has changed, the direction has changed, the viscosity has changed, the amount of material in it has changed. So the line denotes what is called an unconformity. It does not conform to the rest of the movement. Are you with me on these big $1.95 college words? Okay. The question is, how much time passes between the flow movements? Are there seconds, hours, or millions and millions of years? We don't have a clock embedded in the rock. How do you tell how much time passes when you look at that? From a biblical perspective, we would say that's all laid down in a year's time. That's the amount of time the flood was active on the surface of the earth, and we think we can demonstrate that very, very easily from what science is available to us today. But the geologists would disagree with that. Now, by the way, there's been a big shift in geology over the last 20 years since Mount St. Helens erupted. They used to think uniformitarian deposits. They now think catastrophic deposits because of what happened in Mount St. Helens. But they still believe in the ages between the catastrophes. Are you with me here? They've changed their process modeling, their mechanics modeling, to catastrophic modeling. But they still think time. We would suggest that those catastrophes took place in one major catastrophe, and we'll talk about that more. Dr. Parker will cover some of that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the way most of the dating is done is to try to get some sort of date out of igneous rocks. Hear this carefully. You cannot use radiometric dating on sedimentary rocks. Hello? All of the fossils are in sedimentary rocks. You can't get radiometric dating out of sedimentary rocks. You can only get radiometric datings out of igneous rocks like lavas and granites and basalts where there are no fossils. Well, then how come you read in the Seattle Times that when they find a fossil, it's been radiometrically dated at 3.785916 40 through 14 16 17th years old? We'll talk about that. This is the way an evolutionist would look at the side of the Grand Canyon. Gary will cover this, but we would suggest that that's all flood deposits. We'll talk about that a little bit more, okay? I just want you to think a little bit differently this morning and try to think in contrast. Remember, I talked last night about the conflicting worldviews, so kind of keep those contrasts in your mind. From a radiometric dating, as we date this basalt that's down here underneath the bottom of the Grand Canyon and a known lava flow at the top, we did some dating samples at ICR of those two lava flows. The one on the bottom, using radiometric dating techniques that are sanctioned by the evolutionary thinking, the one on the top is older than the one on the bottom. Now, that's a problem. because we know when the one on the top happened, okay? Now, there's some reasons for that, and I'll try to explain it in a minute, but that just sort of something you don't see very often. But what you do see in the literature, remember I talked to you last night about the egghead literature, where the PhDs talk to the PhDs? You don't ever see that in your textbooks. You don't see it in the newspapers or on television. But what you do see in the egghead literature is that when they've dated known existent things, where they know that the basalt is less than 200 years old, when they date it, it comes out 21 million years. When they know that it's only about 1,000 years, it comes out 30 million. Now, this is Mount Stromboli. You know, that's a very famous mountain. It happened 38 years ago. It dates 2.4 million years old. Huh. You know about Mount Etna? Okay. Well, you can just keep doing this all the time using, this is in their literature. In their literature, they're pointing out that, ooh, something's wrong here. Because when I send the specimen to the lab, and the lab doesn't know where it came from, it sends me back a date that just doesn't match history. Just doesn't match it. Well, we would suggest, yeah, there's something wrong with the formula. There's something wrong with the assumptions. There's something wrong with what's going on here. Let's look at some other worldwide processes that may help you think a little bit about this. We know, for instance, that the ocean is essentially the garbage dump for the entire planet. Are you with me on this? Everything that gets cleaned off the land goes into the ocean, okay? The salt content of the ocean is increasing because of all of the muckety-muck that's coming off the land and the fish that are dying. And as Dr. Parker so eloquently discussed, people are defecating in the ocean. And it produces an increase in salts. Now, we can measure the increase of the salt content. That's a pretty easy thing to do. And scientists have been measuring the saline content increase for quite some time. And guess what? If you extrapolate backwards, the ocean cannot be anything more than 62 million years old. Now, wait a minute. The ocean is supposed to be the billion-year-old thing from which everything came. Something's wrong with the formula. Do you understand what's happening here? We don't have a clock that we just keep ticking and bring out every million years or so to see if it's still working. We measure a process during time over a few years or even a century or two, and we get a rate, a process rate, a speed, if you will. And then we calculate backwards to an original amount. It's like doing backward math. That's about what it amounts to. So if we take the rate at which the salt is increasing in the ocean, that speed, if you will, and calculate backwards to where there is no salt, the maximum age of the ocean has to be no more than 62 million years old. Now, wait a minute. I'm not talking about Bible stuff now. I'm talking about evolutionary stuff. And the evolution say, well, that can't be right. It just can't be right. It just can't be right. So what we guess is there has been purging of the ocean by some process unknown to us that purges the ocean every few million years. Okay. Well, what is it? Oh, I don't know. But it can't be 62 million years old. It's got to be billions and billions of years old. So there must be some sort of a process that purges the ocean every few million years and takes it back to zero again. Well, what's the process? I don't know, but it must be. We also know that the continents are eroding, by the way. You know, erosion, just wind and water and stuff like that, eroding the continents. Well, guess what? You'd make everything flat in 14 million years at the rate that's going on today. Now, wait a minute, that can't happen. It certainly didn't happen if the Earth, well, the estimates today range from about 4 to 6 billion years old for the age of the Earth. So we would have had this thing flat a long time ago. Well, that's what they say. Well, see, that's what's causing all these layers in the rock crust, because it washes it all down, it becomes flat, the ocean goes over the top, deposits some fossils, and then the mountains come up again. Okay, How does it do that? Well, I don't know, but it must have happened. Are you kind of understanding some of the stuff that goes on? Sea floors getting full of goop. The maximum for the depth of the seafloor goop, otherwise known as sediments, is 15 million years. Now, why am I giving you these ages? We don't believe for a minute in these ages, but I want you to see that even using their techniques, even using the processes that they swear by, those processes don't fit what we see in science. What we're going to talk about more today is the radiometric dating processes, because that seems to be such a big deal. Now, I don't know whether you've been watching the slide, but as uranium decays into lead, this is what happens normally. Let me help you catch up on science. Now, when I went to school, there were three parts to an atom. There was that blob in the middle called the nucleus. It had a proton and a neutron. Do you remember that? And there were whizzy things on the outside. They were electrons. Do you remember that? Okay, when we talk about the nomenclature of the elements, U-238, that's uranium with 238 whizzy things. That's what it amounts to, okay? Now, because uranium-238 is sort of unstable, it's got more electrons whizzing around the nucleus than the nucleus can hold. So some of those electrons just sort of whiz off. And it will decay over time into an element that has 206 whizzy things. That's lead. So over time, uranium will change into lead because some of the whizzy things are whizzing away. Are you with me? Okay. I mean, that's basic science. More like fifth grade science, but that's about what it amounts to. And we can measure how fast they lose the whizzy things. We can measure the speed of the change. That's called the rate of decay. Have you heard the word half-life? It loses half over a certain period of time, and the next cycle will lose half of the half. The next cycle will lose half of that half, and so on until it gets down to not much. In the atmosphere, what's happening because of some of these decay rates, there is a movement of helium from the Earth to the atmosphere, and we know that rate of movement. Now, that's a worldwide process, okay? So we can shift some of the stuff that's being generated down here into the atmosphere. So it's sort of like another dump up rather than down into the oceans, okay? We're dumping helium. Helium is that stuff that does little funny things to your voice when you suck it from a balloon. You know what I'm talking about? And have you ever noticed that when you fill a balloon with helium and it goes up to the ceiling, if you leave it up there overnight, the next morning it's on the floor? Yeah, that's because helium leaks out. It disperses. It doesn't bond with anything. Well, what we know is that the atmosphere's not full yet of helium, hadn't reached its saturation point. And if you go back to zero, again, the atmosphere can't be any more than 2 million years old. What? No, that can't be. So how do we deal with this? How do you date these rocks? Because when you keep coming back to things, they say, oh, well, there's cycles in this. The only thing that's really stable are the rocks. We find in the rocks the fossils. The fossils tells us the story of evolution. The fossils are the main body of evidence for our evolutionary story. How do you deal with this? How do you date a rock? Does it have wrinkles? I mean, can you figure out a way to look at a rock and tell whether it's old or not? Does it get hard when it's old, or does it get crumbly when it's old? I mean, does it have brittle bones? How do you tell? How can you tell whether a rock's old or not? Obviously, you can't tell from the appearance. You really can't even tell from the dating process, which we'll show in a minute. When argument comes down to, well, I think this versus I think that among the evolutionary scientists, the bottom line arbiter, the final judge, are the fossils that are found near the rock. Well, now, wait a minute. I thought we dated the fossils by the rocks that they were in. No, actually, there are certain things called indexed fossils. All of them are marine invertebrates. Do you know what that is? That's a trilobite or a clam or a jellyfish or a coral or something like that. All of them have index labels to them. If we find this kind of an index fossil, that means it's a Cambrian layer, probably a billion years old or something like that. If we find this kind of fossil, it's probably Cretaceous, maybe 350 to 150 million years old. Well, what about all this radiometric dating stuff? I thought when I read in the paper it says, we dated this fossil by rubidium strontium method and it came out to be 27.943131627 years old. How do we do that? You know about this, right? This is the geologic column. What we see in the textbooks essentially are a graduation of complexity from very simple marine invertebrates down here at the bottom to very complex up toward the top and finally to what we think of as mammals and ultimately man. You see that in every textbook all the time, basically. It's what's taught as the movement of order over time from simple to complex in an evolutionary system of thinking. What you find in the fossil record, however, from every layer from the bottom to the top are marine invertebrates. In fact, in the fossil record, over 95% of all the fossils, pay attention to this, 95% of all the fossils are marine invertebrates. Trilobites, clams. There are clams in Washington, clams in Texas, clams in Florida, clams in Switzerland, clams in, well, clams everywhere. What is left in the fossil record of that 5% remaining, 95% of that are plants. What's left of that little smidgen, most of that are insects. Less than 0.1% of the fossil record are higher order, quote, quote, fossils like mammals and dinosaurs. Not a lot of these supposed high quality fossils when you look at the billions and billions and billions and billions of dead things. What a horrible catastrophe. Well, how long did it take to fossilize something? Here's a bat fossilized on a stalagmite. Now think about this. How did that thing get fossilized on a stalagmite in a cave where it takes millions of years for things to grow? Here's a fossilized fence post. A fence post that was fossilized. It still has nail marks in it and barbed wire marks in it. It's a fossilized. Now, do you understand when a creature gets fossilized, it becomes lithified. It becomes a rock. Dr. Parker was telling me last night, some fossils, as they dig them out, are partially lithified. And so in the un-rock portion of that fossil, you can still find blood cells sometimes. You can still find carbon-14. You can't find carbon-14 in a rock. That's our fossil that's been made into a rock. I don't know whether you've seen this or not. We think it's very significant. This cowboy was murdered in Texas, dumped in a lime pit. His leg got fossilized. The boot didn't because the boot was treated. We call him the limestone cowboy. It doesn't take long to fossilize something. It does take the right conditions. There has to be the chemicals and the pressure and the heat and so on. We also find some other things in the fossils, like in coal. We find human artifacts. Here's a little bowl of some sort. This one is one of our favorites at ICR. It's really a nice looking bell. It's made out of some alloy, and the copper still works. Now, it was found in a coal lump in a seam in Pennsylvania. Huh. Well, they call them anomalous fossils. You know what anomalous means? It ain't supposed to be there. Well, we don't know for sure what it was, but they do find all of these things. Do you know what these are? These are tree trunks embedded in several layers. Dr. Parker will talk about this a good bit more. But essentially, throughout these belts or these pancake layers of different water deposited rock layers, you find single tree trunks like this, and they're all over. They're not one or two things. They're just hundreds of them just about everywhere. And they all appear to have the same sort of function. The root balls are there, but no roots, no branches, no bark. They're interesting things. Here's a set where one tree's upside down. Now, how do you find a tree like this embedded in the fossil record if it was there for millions? And it just doesn't work. Something is going on here that's very different. What about the fossilized tracks? There are lots of these tracks. They get eroded very, very quickly. We find them in the layers. How do we deal with this? From a biblical perspective, we'd say once again that the time that's passing in here is you're dealing with some point. There's no real evidence. I mean, you're trying to find a way to determine how much time passes between those unconformities. We would suggest that when you see something like this in the rock record, it doesn't give any indication of any kind of movement or erosion or anything. It's just like a knife edge all the way across there. When you look at things like the Grand Canyon, what we're suggesting is this, that it's probably nothing more than just what we think of in terms of the biblical flood taking place over a year's time. Dr. Parker's going to spend a good bit of time on the geology when he talks about the Grand Canyon later, so I'm not going to spend much time on it, but I just want you to think of it in terms of a regional deposit. A flood the size of the Bible would have laid down mud flows over continents. We know that this has happened. We know we measure these unconformities. This is one that runs through the Grand Canyon. That mud flow, that layer, runs all the way up into Canada and down into Mexico and across the United States. Now, that's one mud flow laid down by one hydraulic factor where the speed and the sediment and the viscosity were all the same. That's not a local thing. That's a big flood. Here are a couple of coal deposits. Do you understand what a coal deposit is? It's a vegetation mat, essentially, that's been buried deep in the earth. I mean, that's a big bunch of plants glopped together and made into coal with pressure. I want to spend the rest of the time dealing with radiometric dating, because this is the one that everybody has so much trouble with. And I want to warn you here, I don't expect you to take notes on this. If you want it, I can show you how to get most of this freebie over the internet. If you walk in here and see John peeling potatoes and you measure how fast he peels the potatoes, you can come to the conclusion that if you see him peel one potato in a minute and you see 10 peeled potatoes in the bucket, that he's been at it for 10 minutes. Are you with me on this? It's just basic stuff. But that's really what you do in radiometric dating. You count how fast the potato is peeled. You look to see how many peeled potatoes there are in the bucket, and you just multiply. That's really what you do. That's what you do in a mathematical formula. It's not really complex. It can become complex. But what you didn't know is Ken Ham came in earlier and ate some of them. And Dr. Gish, because he's a prankster, came in and put some in the pot. You didn't know that because you weren't here. The trouble is that messes up your multiplication factors, okay? Are you with me on this? If you weren't there, you don't know what happened behind the scenes. And you really didn't even know how many he started with to begin with. That's really what you're dealing with in radiometric dating. You're dealing with a mathematical formula based on assumptions about things you cannot know. Okay? What we're trying to deal with in radiometric dating is figure out how we can age something, date it. We got to know the initial conditions. That's how many potatoes we had to start with, how many of them were peeled and how many were not. We got to know how fast the potatoes are being peeling. And we got to know if John was faster in the beginning or slower in the end because his arm is getting tired. Okay, are you with me? We got to know that the rate is always the same. And we have to assume there's no Ken Ham and no Dr. Gish. That nothing changes the information. Are you with me on this? I don't want to be too simple, but I want you to understand the process is not that complicated. The mathematics gets a little hairy, but, well, the same questions apply. You're looking at the same set of assumptions. How do I know these initial conditions? How do I know how fast it went? How do I know what the initial conditions were? Even small variations can make a huge change when you're talking about billions of years. How do I know? Radiometric dating has only been around about 100 years. We only use about four. These are the main ones right here to give us the long ages. Now, I mentioned several other worldwide processes to give us much too young ages. They don't use those because they don't want to have anything young. They want to have something old. So the ones that they use are primarily these three: uranium to lead, potassium to argon, rubidium to strontium, and other two that I can't possibly pronounce. Now, what they really do is measure the speed of the decay, measure how fast those whizzy things are leaving. Are you with me on this? And as they measure that speed, they come up with this half-life number. But an awful lot of decay rates in the radioactive field have much, much shorter half-lives. They're much faster decay rates. These are the only ones that give us really long ones. They're the ones they like to use. Now, this decay rate, they assume, remains constant, that the rock samples have to be closed systems. Now, before you get too lost in this, what they're saying is, when I measure a uranium to lead date, what I'm doing is saying, I assume that the uranium had some initial condition. Let's just, for simplicity, say it was all uranium when it started. I've got 50% lead now, 50-50. So knowing the rate, the speed of the decay from uranium to lead, I can assume that it took X, Y, Z. Just multiply those out. But uranium is water soluble. That is, water will dissolve it, like an underground water flow or leakage from rain or the bottom of a lake or a dam burst or just all kinds of things can make my assumption wrong unless I know what the initial conditions were. Now, that's something that's hard to know when you're talking about millions and millions or billions and billions. Everybody wants to know about carbon-14, but most people don't know what carbon-14 is. So let me give you a real quick, simple education. Carbon-14 comes from the upper atmosphere, all right? Nitrogen-14 produces carbon-14. Carbon-14 combines with oxygen to become carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is absorbed in plants. We eat the plants. We get carbon-14 in our bodies. All right, carbon-14 is not natural carbon. Carbon-14 is radioactive. Carbon-12 is natural carbon. 14 means it's got two extra whizzy things. Are you with me on this? That's what it means. It's got two extra electrons in the system, and those extra electrons are radioactive. That is, they radiate outward. Are you with me? Where this come from? They just whiz off into space. And carbon-14 will decay back to its natural state over a measurable period of time. That's all radiometric dating is doing. Okay, you with me now? What I want you to get out of this, carbon-12 remains constant after the thing dies. Carbon-12, carbon-14 is only in biologically active materials, plants, animals, people, okay? When the thing dies, it stops eating, it stops ingesting carbon-14, and it begins losing the carbon-14 and will ultimately go back to zero again. Are you with me on this? It's pretty obvious stuff. It's not terribly simple, but a lot of people don't understand the process. What we do is to measure the ratio, the change between carbon-14 and carbon-12. We just measure the difference, plus and minus, and calculate backwards based on the half-life. While the thing is alive, it maintains a balance. The ratio is zero. When it dies, you lose carbon-14, and you get a change, a delta, a difference between them. Are you with me on this? This is not terribly complex, but that's really what all we're doing here. Okay, what do we deal with? Carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,730 years. All that means is the whizzy things leave at a rate that can be measured so that half of it is gone in 5,700 years. Are you with me on this? 5,700 years later, half of the half is gone. So in 11,460 years, we've got one quarter of the amount. Another 5,700 years, we've got one eighth. After that, 1/16, 1/32. Are you with me on how this just halves each time? Okay. Carbon-14 is so short, in 20 half-lives, which is about 115,000 years, the amount of carbon-14 left is so small it's impossible to measure. So for all practical purposes, after 100,000 years, really after about 50,000 years, you can't even detect it. Just the fraction is so small then, there's so little left, you really can't tell that there's anything there at all. Okay, are you with me? For that reason, carbon-14 is never used for long ages. It's always used for short things. You'll see it in the paper from time to time. Well, this was 40,000 years, this was 50,000 years, this was 30,000 years. We would take issue with that, but let's leave it alone for the moment. From a linear purpose, that is just a straight line, mathematically straight, you'd just lose detectability after about 50,000 years, 40,000, 50,000 years. All right. Part of the problem has been geologists, not Christians, not creationists, but just ordinary evolutionary geologists, have been measuring carbon-14 in coal for a long time. And they've been reported, remember egghead to egghead, that literature? They've been reporting it for a long time, that there's been some real interesting amounts of carbon that have carbon-14 measured in coal. That's about 1,000 times more carbon-14 than the measurable threshold by the instruments that are available to us today. So there's still a lot of carbon-14 in coal. Don't lose the context here. Coal is supposed to be 10 million at the earliest, 150 million probably, 300 million years maybe. There ought not to be any carbon-14 thing. So goodness gracious, we don't know what this is. And certainly past a million years, there ought not to be nothing. Well, we got curious. We at ICR formed a company, a group called RATE, Radioactive in the Age of the Earth, Radioactive Dating in the Age of the Earth. We went to a coal bank. Did you know there's a coal bank? There's a coal bank in Pennsylvania that holds samples of all the coal deposits all over the world. They do core samples down there. So it's kind of like a bank for geologists. They love this stuff. So we went to this coal bank in Pennsylvania and we got some coal samples from each of the main eras in the geologic column. The youngest one on top, the oldest one on the bottom. And we took samples from every one of the coal banks, every one of the coal layers, and said, we're going to send these off to the major laboratories in the world and have them date these samples as a blind sample. Now, scientists do this all the time. You know what a blind sample is? It's just in a bag, and it says, please date this. We don't tell them where it came from. Scientists do this all the time because that's supposed to be the way to test and reproduce things. Well, we did that. We found some interesting things. From this supposed rather old process up here, we found an awful lot of carbon-14. We found about the same amount in the other twos. Cretaceous, that's the age of the dinosaurs, okay? Pennsylvanian is the age of the fish. Now, that's supposed to be about 350 million years old. That shouldn't be. No, there shouldn't be any carbon-14 there at all, okay? Well, any carbon-14 that's measurable past 50,000 years is a real problem for an evolutionist, but to find something in coal beds that's supposed to be millions of years old, That's a problem. The average of all of those samples would, if you just had a linear age date, is about 50,000 years. Now, wait a minute. That tells us a number of things. It would say that all the coal was laid down at about the same time, not very long ago. Well, there's something else here. We know from the fossil record that the time that the fossils laid down, there was a lot more biological material around than there is today. Estimates are about 100 times. That is more living things, more plants, more animals, more living things were around at the time that those fossils were deposited, so that there would be more carbon-14 in the plant systems and in the living systems than there is today. So you have to factor in that change to give you a pretty good estimate of what really remains. And we would suggest using that ratio of about 40% difference, that all of those dates come out pretty close to what we think the flood was, about 4,200, 4,500 years ago. What does that do for us? Well, we got to thinking, if there's carbon in coal, maybe there's carbon in diamonds, because diamond is a carbon-based product. Are you with me on that? You know that. You know we can make diamonds today? You do. You ladies do know that, right? You can buy one of those cheap things. Guess what? We found about half. Coal samples had a mean of 0.247. The diamonds had a mean of about 1.14. Diamonds are the hardest things we know anything about that are naturally made, okay? Nothing gets out of a diamond. You can't get radioactive material leaking out of a diamond. Are you with? The whizzy things would bounce up against the roof, okay? And to find carbon-14 in diamonds would suggest that diamonds are not very old at all, and they were formed in a process that's relatively fast. When you see the advertisement, diamonds are forever, it's not talking about your love. That's talking about the age of the diamond, because they believe it's millions and millions and millions of years old. But what we're suggesting is, goodness gracious, there's essentially the same amount of carbon in those diamonds as there is in coal, indicating they've all been formed pretty close to the same amount of time ago in history. Well, what does this essentially tell us? That all of these fossil-bearing strata have evidence that they were all laid down about the same time. All of the fossil-bearing strata were laid down about the same time. I hear Genesis 6, 7, and 8 in that. That's an interesting issue. It's a real problem for an evolutionist, because when they look at it, there just is really no way to answer this except say, well, it's just contaminated. But how do you contaminate coal from every layer with the same amount of contamination all over the world at the same time? How do you do that? How do you contaminate something like that? No reasonable person would indicate that that's possible. There's really no secret plot here. It's just, well, what about radio halos? Do you know what a radio halo is? Most people don't. I won't bore you with the technical. But when uranium decays into lead, those whizzy things go off and leave trails in the rock. Now, they can only leave a trail when the rock is congealing. They can't leave a trail while the rock is still liquid. They can't leave a trail after the rock has hardened. They can only leave a trail while the rock is in its plastic state, like taffy or fudge or something like that. Are you with me? Okay. So these halos are really spherical, three-dimensional basketball-type marks where the whizzy things running away from the center of the atom leave a burn mark or a trail in the rock, and they're called radio halos. They're like a spherical ball, and they have very different characteristics. They're just very easy to spot. What's happening, these alpha particles are leaving trails as it goes there. We looked at two of them because they're very, very different. Polonium halos are very quick. One of them, just almost in a blink of an eye, microseconds. The uranium halos are supposed to take 100 million years to decay. It has a long half-life. Now, you wouldn't expect to find a uranium halo in the same spot as a polonium halo. Are you with me on this? One of them takes 100 million years to make its basketball. The other one does it in a few microseconds. So you won't, you know what a microsecond is, by the way? That's a millionth of a second. Some of the polonium halos take a little longer than that. But what we tried to do, because there was some research done on granites for a long time that indicated there were different kinds of halos available down there, we took granites, because granites are supposed to be the oldest rocks. They're down here at the bottom of everything, okay? They're supposed to be a billion years old and older. If you ever seen granite, you know that in normal granite, it's kind of grayish and you've got black flecks and sparkly flecks in it. You know what I'm talking about? The black flecks are biotites. The sparkly things are zircons. They're crystals that are formed as the rock congeals. As the rock goes from liquid to solid, there's a period of time where it is sort of plastic, like fudge or taffy. And during that time, crystals are formed. Some of them are dark, they're called biotite. Some of them are light and translucent, they're called zircons. They're in all granites. Now, granite comes in all kinds of colors, but the common granites are just gray. That's the stuff you see on the sides of most mountains. Huh, okay. Boy, that was hard to get out, wasn't it? We took polonium-210 because it has a half-life of about 138 days, about 4 months, okay? It takes 4 months for that thing to decay. Uranium halos are supposed to take 100 million years to decay, so they're very, very, very different halos, all right? And they shouldn't be in the same rock. Okay, are you with me? I mean, they shouldn't be there, because if they can only leave their mark when the rock is solidifying, not when it's liquid and not when it's hard, they can only do it in the middle. You ought not to find the same there. But what we began to uncover was that literally everywhere in all the granites that we looked at from all over the world, they all had both kinds of halos in them. Huh. The polonium halo would indicate a very rapid cooling for the rock. I mean, if it leaves its mark in 4 months, I mean, it's got to cool down pretty quick. Well, what we found in many of them was sort of like these trails of halos, indicating that these things were just continually going on over a very rapid process. And then we began to find, well, let me back up here to this one, because I want you to understand some interesting things about this. Let me get up here where you can see the picture. Have you ever played with mica? You know, mica has like little flakes on it. You can peel back the layers. That's very typical of a crystal structure. They have what they call lattices. They're just, you can peel them back. There's structures to them. When we began to look at these halos are very small, so you have to peel back and look at the little peel, and then you have to slice the peel and put at it edgewise under a microscope to see the circle. Are you with me on how we would do this? You can understand what's going on here. What we began to find was in the same layer, in the same flake, in the same sliver, were both polonium and uranium halos in the same sliver of biotite. Hello, don't miss this. That's a four-month-old halo and a 100-million-year-old halo in the same flake. And we didn't just find it once, we found it almost all the time. Now that tells us several things. But while we were doing that, we began to look at the sparkly things, the zircons. And we said, you know, if these are really young, there ought to be some helium in these things. Because helium is the kind of stuff that can escape anywhere. It's, you know, remember the balloon, you put it up on the ceiling, it falls down? Helium doesn't bond with anything. So we began to look at these zircons knowing that the maximum age of the Earth would have to be much younger than most people think it is, given just the evolutionary assumption. So we began to look at these zircon crystals. They collect these uranium and thorium atoms, they decay into lead, and as they move and give off these alpha particles, it's an interesting thing. The decay process produces only 8, and always 8 alpha particles. I mean, it's an interesting thing. So we knew that we could calculate the amount, the quantity of the helium that we would expect to find. And as we began to look, we discovered that there was an interesting amount of helium remaining. As a matter of fact, what we found was that the deeper down the rock, basically the hotter the rock is because more pressure, more, you know, you all understand this, I guess. But there was a lot of helium down there, and we began to say, well, look, let's see if we can predict what we're going to find. And we made a chart based on the Earth being only 6,000 years old and compared it with a chart based on the average age of the granites that are supposed to be on the Earth, about 1.5 billion years old. And we said, what would we expect to find? Now, this is what scientists do. They predict something, then they test the accuracy of the prediction. Are you with this? That's how formulas are done. That's all the time. What we found to our delight and surprise was that this bar down here represented what we would expect to find in 1.5 billion year old zircons. This is the bar that we'd expect to find if the Earth was 6,000 years old. And it's interesting. It marked just right on track with what we predicted would be there if the Earth is 6,000 years old. Whoa, that's interesting. There just doesn't seem to be any indication that the Earth is very old at all. And when we began to look at this stuff in combination, the carbon-14 in the coal deposits indicate all the coal was deposited at the same time. The diamonds in there indicate that the diamonds were made about the same time as the coal, not so very long ago, probably within 5,000 years. We looked at the radio halos down in granites. We found both the short ones and the long ones in the same biotite flakes, indicating two things. One, that they were formed at the same period of time, that the cooling rate of the rock was very short, and secondarily, that the radioactive decay rates had some vast changes in them. Something was making the decay rates be different, either slowing the polonium or speeding up the uranium, because you can't have them in the same rock at the same time with very different decay rates. We don't measure those changes today. We don't measure the differences in speed today. So something must have been going on that would change those speeds, and the helium in the zircons would indicate, goodness gracious, those rocks aren't very old at all. All right, what do we do with this? What we're essentially suggesting, and by the way, all of this material is published, is on our website. You can get it and download it. You can get gigabytes of stuff off of our website for nada. It's free. All you have to do is just get on a computer and download it and pay for the paper and the ink. My favorite Baptist preacher. He makes the point that often the majority are wrong. Often. In fact, more often than not. And the thing which does not change, that which is immutable, is the Word of God. Those of us who have the privilege of being part of God's family should have more confidence in its accuracy, even if we don't have the evidence. But when we begin to find the evidence, well, that's why we do what we do. That's why we suggest you get these kinds of materials. If you need some documentation, get some of these books. Be able to respond with this information. This is not that technical. It does require a little bit of thinking, but it is there. That's why these books were published. That's why these things are available for you, because I want you to have access to the same information that the Lord is opening up for us. We make it available to you so that you can begin to do the witness. Now, we're going to have a break for about 30 minutes.